This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
An experience.
I found that now the word that it comes from is the word Newman, and I found that my idea of Newman was a little confused, but mildly, because I do not share the Roman idea of Newman. But I thought that Newman was the place or thing where the God was. That had the presence of the God, but then somebody reminded me that this was possibly the presence or the spirit itself. The word numinous never occurs. It occurs first, I think, in Rudolf, or at least he may claim to having coined it, in Rudolf Otto's idea of the holy. And it belongs entirely to our 20th century. Numinous means something different from the whole world of the Newman. But the fact that the world of the Newman is pre-Christian, and the world of the Numinous is belongs to the Christian world, trying to reclaim the qualities that were there in these old places and things. But it is still Christian because it refers to experience. This refers to a place or thing where you felt it, but I mean it was there, it was recognized there, it was compelling. This refers to a compelling experience, and one thing that you're going to find where Olson and I have in common, but I think it's much of our whole modern, real modern 20th century frame of thought, is we still, in this cult of experience, and that's really, when Partisan Review wanted to fight, and did fight a little more against all these people, Lawrence particularly, and the people of this period, of the first phase of this poetic cult of experience, all of them, Boston and a whole group of them, attacked the cult of experience, which they viewed as vaguely fascist and so forth, or vividly fascist, and opposed the civilized whatever to this cult. But that phrase is very good because this is a cultist, and this is a very different cultist. This is not a cultist of the rock or a cult of the play, the cult of the fountain or the cult. This is a cult of experience. But it took this word, after all, the cult of experience had other words. It taking that meant that this cult of experience had begun again to be a cult of the place, a cult of the rock, a cult of the fountain. And it, from here, via Jung, now this is Rudolf Otto, and very soon, I think Rudolf Otto is before the First World War, I'm not sure, I think he's around 1910 or something like that. Very soon, Jung is using it very, very happily, and his analytic patients or victims, depending on our point of view, are bathed in the numinous, that is soon. And from Whitehead, you have the real thing of Charles Olson, Locus. Of the field, which he found, now this is a meadow or field, and I don't know what he's going to do with the pun in the poem, it doesn't expand in that direction. Of that place where the young man was killed by the bull in Gloucester, Charles said to me, it says in the poem, as a matter of fact, said to me, but it says in a different way in the poem, it was then when he found out that event had taken place that he knew Gloucester was one of the pits of the earth. Now he was saying something to me that was, I knew, he's not saying it seemed as if, he said, then when I found out that took place, I knew that in Gloucester there was one of the pits of the earth. And the image emerges finally in Maximus of the 600 who had drunk from the pits of the earth. Who is great, what? Mother or cow mother, but had there were certain places then. Well, Charles thought Eleusis. Well, there were certain places where events happened, and they wouldn't. Have, as a matter of fact, you might be the tips of the earth might be. They were wherever this had happened, and wherever some real. You see that being killed is some, I was going to say catastrophic event, but one which is exceeding, which is ultimately passionate, in which all the other values of life have just been gathered into this one locus. At the moment of a violent death, for instance, we are all aware of one thing about a violent death, and that is that the past and future thing is completely then brought into only the present moment. And that all of life seems to be how you met that. The great excitement about a catastrophic death is how, then only your quality tells you what the quality of that moment is going to be. And if it's passionate, if for instance you are as in the crucifixion, then you have God present in the locus. If it winds and goes, and all the stages of what man can define that. Well, but then Charles has something else there, and that is he has begun to feel something out of this or that, because he did mean something different. He didn't mean how the man met, nor how the bull and the man acted there. He said he knew then that there was an earth place. Now this means that his idea of the newman had increased to such a place that he had been looking for something that was key in that Gloucester was one of the holy places of the world. Now the word newman has become, because Otto wanted to find the idea of the holy again. And in the early, the Maximus is what you've read, if you've read Maximus, reread in this light, because Charles is not thinking of it yet, because he thought he found it there, thing on Tansy, and you'll find him discovering that there was Tansy in Gloucester. And the thing I'm sure that was in back of discovering that there was Tansy in Gloucester means that Gloucester was one of the holy places. I now know I am present, and this flower is not just a flower, it is part of the fairy world that is present in this flower. When the flower lists are not just flower lists, and belong to the fairy religion, as there are many people who believe Shakespeare belong in practice, then Tansy, but it's also the Tansy of the witches and the Tansy of the magical herbs. Now, one of the reasons, in the first part, I told you that, or I suggested, and I think this is, I don't know where, but in the beginning, Charles's interest in particulars and in documents was a little like pounds, but it had changed because of the whole economic importance of documents, so that you're also historically documenting them, not documenting them in the sense you did in the thesis, but showing that such and such really happened. That documentation begins once he gets the vision of Maximus to have an entirely different significance. But it's still there, and it's there in pounds. That is, your document begins to be like it is in magic. And you have no alternative but to use those words. What they did in magic, and we haven't got too much evidence for all sorts of happy results, but poetry and religion and so forth have left also an unfortunate impression. You see, we're talking about, the minute we talk about magic, we think of two different things. One is marvelous, quite as marvelous as any poem or any drama or anything else. And that's what those magicians went through with all their rites and so forth and their life around them. It made life extremely exciting, and it made all sorts of things come into relationship, and it gave them a trajectory. But the other part, of course, of what we're aware of is that the trajectory in magic often, in almost any place we read, has so many sorry failures to it. And although there are people who don't like art and can remind us all over the place of the sorry failures that are involved in the life of a poet, my mother, who for instance didn't rejoice at all, when by the time I was already 21, I was still determined to be a poet, and there was no sign of talent, I mean, in my eyes, the same joyful ego I have today. I've never been troubled in my life by talent, and I just simply had the rapturous conviction in my own trajectory. However, there was a certain amount of There was nothing from those early years, let's say, that I treasured in my little treasure chest. But my mother, however, I don't think was looking at those because she just explained to me. She said something that is a predominant view of the careful middle class, and that is, poets just contribute to the unhappiness of themselves and the world. Well, immediately, I was already somewhat aware of Milton and how mean he was to those daughters. there was only one happy figure, and that might have been a figment of people worrying about poets, and that was Shakespeare's retiring and kind of over-drinking some evening. That's the third night. But some of the others were absolutely dreadful, and particularly somebody like Baudelaire in the 19th century, who was just somebody who didn't want to live. Well, so that wasn't much better than magicians. That couldn't be the whole picture. So let's get back to Olson. What was happening in Olson's mind, and it was partly the influence of Jung, but it was partly the vision he could have in Whitehead, because this is a heady thing. Process and reality were a picture of a cosmos, and you'll find in Human Universe, I know where you particularly find it, and that's in a letter that to somebody that follows the thing on projective verse, and then in a letter about later views on projective verse, and he opposes cosmos to psyche. Absolutely for this, absolutely against this world of psyche. Now, I have ways of reading things so much for my own use that this appeared after the Pindar poem was written, but when I read, I mean, this paper on that letter, when it appeared in a little magazine, appeared after the Pindar poem was written. But when it appeared, for instance, I just didn't even register cosmos and psyche, because they were so charged with importance for me. That is, they were so charged for some kind of decision I was not going to make consciously, I had to work with that, and I didn't yet want to think through what was happening. And I had not yet done, let's say, I had to finish the field, and I did not want to have results happening from the Pindar poem outside of the ones that were within this area of the field. I had to go for a year and a half. At the end of that, I suddenly reread that letter again and noticed that it was about cosmos and psyche. But you learn that this is part of the magic operation. You almost become blind to these two terms because they have gathered some kind of prohibition. There are things you should not. So there are laws operating when you are trying to have something happen. Charles begins to have something happen. And you can't read projective verse without realizing that when he talks about trajectory or field or something, he's thinking of process. He's trying to picture, the minute he starts trying to picture head and heart as operative, no matter what he decides, whether he decides that head's going to do the measuring and heart's going to do the hearing or something, or he's already beginning to do what I was doing when I was walking back and forth. And he's already beginning to be magically involved. Let's swing back towards a group that around the first part of the century, around the same period of the images, were studying Greek drama, and Jane Harrison changed. She's the real change that comes after Fraser into the new thing, and Jane Harrison had started to study poetry. She felt there must be something more vital than Euripides really was. She started with a theory that Euripides and Sophocles and Aeschylus were a revival of a cult life, of the old religion in the terms of stage at its very last point, because after that you really don't find it. And that they would give you a more vital key to what the old religion was than somebody like Hesiod, who was sort of designing an argument. Now, Hesiod's very devout, so it could give you a lot. And Pindar, for instance, gives you even more, because Pindar is a reactionary, and a reactionary never knows what it is they say in between times. But Jesus, for instance, is sort of a solid man and a farmer sort of type, so only his devoutness shows what the old religion might be. Anyway, going back to those dramas, she began to make it clear that the Only vital point of poetry was at a point when everything in the life was so involved with it that it meant motion and doing things. And she talked then about that there had been a thing called the dromana, which was what they did, and the mutos. This is to be after mutos. Which was what they said. And the two went together, or sang, this is probably that song. Now, what they did was not the thing they're telling about, but what they did. They were both in the same moment. And then back of that, now, had she only done that, and this was vital, it meant that there was, it was parallel to a constant restlessness in modern poetry in an area that was going to begin to be more and more misunderstood, in which people wanted poems to be operating. And tomorrow, when I start talking about my own work, or maybe a touch of time, because I'm supposed to be talking about structured rhyme tomorrow, when Olson met me, and that first poem he was interested in, the medieval scene, was just such a drone and a movement. And those poems had consequences in the life around me. They interfered, let's say, like gossip does. But what the chorus does, you stand around, the nearest to a Greek chorus in our contemporary scene is something we all participate in when we gossip. And what we do when we gossip is we get very nervous about something that's liable to happen. If that girl, Medea, goes on this way, well, you know she's going to probably kill those children, and a good, honest Greek woman wouldn't be letting this. You know, I feel that it's very likely, but actually this is the thing that still goes on in our day, and it's a prayer for this marvelous news. The only glory man knows is the glory that gets cured on a psychoanalytic bench. The difference between somebody who's gotten straightened out and Oedipus, who tears his eyes out with the brooch, is that Oedipus stands in the only glory that man knows. Because Oedipus has put a law over himself and risen in that law through his consequences and is liberated. I mean, all right, he finally comes to the epiphany and is actually shattering, and he sees that the consequence of his law is to tear his eyes off. And everything that happens on the analytic bench is trying to weasel out of the consequences of the law. So he can't. Let's say we need to weasel the law. And he's not me. Well, at least I'm just one of not
Carolina.
Really?
Didn't marry mother.
But I'm trying to give you that, because for the modern sensibility that belongs to this world that avoids this, Christ himself is sort of a sick baby on that cross. There's been only a nice psychoanalyst along the line who would explain to him about Papa and Mama and about it wasn't really very important that you weren't sure who Papa was. All of us know that God's our all a father all around. That boy would never have to go through such terrible things in order to cry out on the cross, I have stuff, you know. But I'm trying to get. But poetry is just opposite. It's trying to get. But then it takes imagination to imagine this moment. Trying, you don't arrive at it. You do not know where this moment lies. Oedipus doesn't really know where it is. He needs cooperation of a real. Tiresias has to do. Everybody cooperates. And this cooperation then is part of why things take place in poetry in things called movements, groups of poets. And they actually answer each other back and forth, and they try to have some crisis precipitated. And back of Maximus then was trying to use, always forcing himself, just as he tried all of a sudden took no matter what the consequences were going to be, took Melville as a law over him, and said, I will write Moby Dick. I will live in this dimension. Well, there are humorous angles because, of course, the most terrible thing we can think of is Moby Dick, because he only had 80 readers. And so, our mind is someone. I mean, we would be likely today to worry how many people are around looking at the cross. Then, as a matter of fact, the movie show has been thousands. And if anybody today dares show a crucifixion in which you're about in my lifetime, when I was in college in 35, we were looking, and after we would cut out certain pictures, and they were by Matisse and Picasso, and Matisse and Picasso were becoming exciting to us because they had produced these pictures, and we looked at others to see if there would be more like them, one with the woman looking in the mirror, and these were great events. But by the time 1940 came, we could look at millions and say, that's a Matisse, that's a Picasso, that's a Miro, that's a... And now you look and you say, well, that's probably $10,000. And sold an auction last year for $250,000. A new art book, you have to look way down the line for print to see who possibly painted it. And once you lose a series of auction prices like this, and the real way to go to a gallery today to show that you know everything is to say, well, now probably in 2 or 3 years that this... I think Monticello is a good buy today because if they really, this money thing and this audience thing is, and now I'm just going back to the fact that one of the awful tragedies in my mind as I'm trying to talk about it is the only 80 readers. It could not have been what Olson found in Melville. What Olson found in Melville was something else. Melville was not the one that I found that transformed me, that gave me the point at which I was going to find out what it was that was the secret of life. But we do know one thing in Melville, even just forgetting the 80 readers and realizing suddenly that can't possibly be the tragedy or anything else in any man's life. And then thinking, no, it must be what the book is and what and this that happens in the book, and the terror he had when he tried to develop the theme of the Kraken in Pierre. And then what these two things, the whale and the Kraken, mean to us, once we put them together in a long tradition of where they were. In Charles's work coming from that, now I think I can get at something of something else that's been got to know, the great difficulty is to find that Kraken. Now that was acceptable to Melville. That was one thing he had to tell about. He had found it in himself, and it can't be just located as some particular thing. It was an intense sense he had it really. And part of the process, the nearest that Charles comes to anything that is as absolutely mad or lunatic as the reality of the whale. I'm not thinking of Ahab's idea of the whale, because that's one of the many people looking at that whale. As the reality of that whale, or the reality of the thing in Pierre, which is the many-armed deception through the whole thing, so you can't find your way. I mean, some sense of life that is of a condition in life that is a kind of many-armed thing and the money on all these people and certainly has something to do with realizing that everything is reciprocal, so that everybody together form one big being in that group that are in here. One of the first places then for Charles for finding that, and Maximus was trying to be a prophet for it, are these tips of the earth. Now that is certainly is right. And yet you can find origins in other places, in other parts of human experience, for this impression that the earth feeds us. And this is just not the food. This is not just the food that we have from the farms that we talked about originally. But I may have been talking about farms in the Ukraine and exploiting them when you weren't really connected with those tips, of the actual tips of the earth, because I also was talking about the kind of force of something the earth was. And people felt this at times. Well, it is certainly belongs to the realm that seems, if it is not Newman, it's what is accused of being over here. Lunacy or out of the moon, as poets were all through the realm of the rational form. Now, let's get back to a little bit about what happens in the magic operation in witchcraft. There, you have to work on a formula, and this is what really tied up alchemists, but we can go to our own alchemy and think of the creeds, and they're used in Patterson, by the way, for just exactly this feeling about the poem. The creeds knew that there was something in the pitch blend. Now, they knew it in their own scientific terms, that is, their intuition was not just from some other source. Their intuition is chemical. But they did not know what it could possibly be. They did not know in what terms they could find it, and it was perfectly conceivable that the Kuris might never have found it. They would only have had to die someplace before they got there, and they took a long time to get there. And they might have, they would have been the only ones, because nobody else was very thrilled about all that pitch land, and they were themselves getting rather discouraged about what they were going to arrive at. Now, alchemists did this, and they got a lot of things along the way, but they were looking for something else. And the Jungian, for instance, stresses that they were looking for something spiritual. That seems to be quite clear. And Jung is very good in that book on his psychology and alchemy because he's got very close to seeing that our only realm of spirit is in the things we're doing. Now, this is the meaning of a creative act, that it is a spiritual event, and it can't just take place. Something has to be done. Something has to be enacted. Something has to be made. And the little secret poets kept going, even in the worst times, was that when you made a poem, no matter what somebody else was going to do with it as far as being a commodity or an object of value, if you took it as an entire experience, and if you were responsible throughout, keeping its laws throughout, this would mean a change in spirit. And then Charles, with the Maximus, erected major laws. It meant that he was going to use all of Gloucester as experimental terms for a field in which his spirit was going to live and only live, finally. And because his objective correlative, for instance, would be from this place, and it would be then so that you see why he was looking. I'm trying to get why he was looking for proof that it was a place. When he knew it could furnish an event that he could see, and he must have thought himself clairvoyantly. I mean, he must have seen it in order to believe in that event, because, you know, you can throw the ball anyway. No, but look, this dual meaning we have. We talk about tossing the ball and have our disregard for it, too, because we felt cheated over and over again. Almost every item of the holy has an expression in our common speech that means, oh, that's just nothing. And every one of those, that's just nothing. Every time we say them, we'll say shift, which is extremely important in the whole magical operation, and we have only to think of our agriculture and the fact that now we increasingly try to use chemical fertilizers and not the actual shift. The actual shift we put in the salt water where we hope it will do nothing. It's the same general feeling, but and it's because the oh shift remark is entirely our disappointment that it had not yielded this experience. We know that people with aberrations who come into some kind of intense experience in eating shit, covering themselves with it, and so forth. And we do know, kind of know, yes, as compost is worse, I guess, but none of us raised in vegetables. We are the first civilization that has thought the thing to do with it is to put it in a porcelain bowl and then quickly get it out of sight. And scientists, by the way, don't. Scientists at the present time, one of the wonderful ironies is in the very period when we're triumphantly living in plumbing, and yet the only way they did finally find out where that rice came from, by the way, and where the first wheat was grown, is because only 5 years ago did those archaeologists realize that people wanted to know what was in the turds, not what the bowls were like any longer. And suddenly they actually found not few fossils. Because how did you know what the people were eating? There's no way of knowing what the people are eating except in those few fossilized remains. And we have erased so successfully they'll never know we ate everything in the world except. I mean, they'll know nothing about those chocolate-covered bees because we've just successfully trying to erase our history as rapidly as possible. Well, I didn't really mean that he found an outhouse. But the fear of the thing done and the thing said, and when experience did feed you. Now let's think again of the because this Maximus will soon be in print someplace, and anyway, you. It's such a valuable discovery at a point. think of the fact that the very meaning of being fed by something also means those meaningful moments of experience fed us somehow and changed us somehow. And they were all moments of something that was responsibility. Now, combined with the business of suffering and the way Dewey interpreted and used it, suffering and undergoing an experience, it combines with the idea that the Christians really did have, that you see before the Christians, the God himself bore all the suffering, and the identification could be intense during the priesthood, but in Christianity you have increasingly an interpretation in which Christians actually underwent, could share in this, and this became an experience, not just a part of another rite. And our feeling then that we wish experience would be. Now, I made fun of the people on the couch, but the people on the analytic couch are really people for whom experience no longer gives us food. People where life has gone dry. So they are also looking, and actually, of course, Freud's great power was he using this forbidden word soul. The modern consciousness had all just about dropped it. Soul gave us nothing, and they started soul with sentimental or so references. So what do you mean, soul? I heard plenty of that in 1935 or 36. And psyche was the best we could do, but actually psyche gave us the locus of when soul came into existence at all, because it came in with the story of psyche, with the story of the Christ, and with the figures of the period between 200 BC and 200 AD. And the whole idea of a psychic experience. Now, back here. Charles laid down one law: nothing should be in Maximus that wasn't in Gloucester for himself. And he did not. If you were to compare Maximus with Patterson, and it's a comparison that will really reveal immediately something, the first thing you see in Patterson is something that Patterson, that Williams himself had gotten from Joyce. That is, Williams was one of the transition followers, and so he read from the very beginning that Joyce's new work was in four parts and had a series of four, and then he had taken from Vico a picture of history that had had a childhood, a middle age, a death, and then a recourse, though, to the beginning, to the childhood. And then he read also in the 20s, this thing of Joyce's was that this man of in the Joyce, Finnegan himself, was a great giant who was spread out along and that his wife was a river, the Liffey, and that he was the city of Dublin also, and that his head was there in his hands and so forth, so that he was a city man. So Williams borrows, you know, this is exactly, Williams is in this, at the level of the total composition of the structure, at this level of structure, I mean, in Patterson. Patterson is a thoroughly and absolutely conventional story, structured. Well, Finnegan was. Although, I'm not going to, something else happens in Finnegan. The thing that's not conventional is where Joyce is looking, after all, he was so blind, he could not handle the larger structure, so he always had to be there in the word, and there he did nothing that would be happening. But Williams, on all the total large structures, taking across making a city man Patterson to match the city man Finnegan in Dublin, taking across Patterson where you're going to have the falls and so forth and the different stages, and language is automatically going to go to pieces as it does in the divorce section because we're teaching Joyce. But he wanted to have a framework for a large poem. Now that, luckily, is not what happens in the actual poem. But the total structure, for instance, Pound's total structure is still in process of getting realized. To what it will be depends on its totality. All the way along the line is growing organically, and whether he'll arrive at it, no. But of course, anybody who's got hands who start section one, section two, section three, section four, youth, middle age, death, recorso, and fits things into these categories at this level is going to have his form before he starts in. And he can't possibly be working at that because we could do it. I mean, you know, we decide, well, literal,
open eggs in the first section, and the grown-up chickens in the second section, and the poor old dying rooster in the third section, and so forth. And actually, that sort of thing, and Joyce, of course, this sort of systematic thing, it makes for an entirely playful and conventional level of thinking. And it is what scholars unwound. They've unwound that one clear down to the last, because it was entirely in a conventional tradition. And Patterson is exactly sensible to that. What bugged Randall Jarrell, who was reading Patterson marvelously at the level of his conventional structure, were all the elements that were forced. All the elements that actually were a process of making that went on, because actually Williams was just not, let's say, he was, well, the sort of things that might go on within a conventional sense that could go in on going in. And so when Williams takes up the theme from Pound, the theme of the credit of language and its meaning, and relates that to money, and our whole total society's disturbance about credit and circulation and goods. In the third book, Gerald's response was, oh, he's just taking that dreadful Pound stuff again. But he had not taken a form or anything, not taken a convention from Pound. He'd taken a theme, and theme is very different. The themes of poetry are eternal, and they feed, and they are real sources. They are like they are part of the existence of this. There are ticks of poetry and the moon and pulses and the ideas of love as they flow in the continuous tradition. Well, we need only to refer to that tradition that Dante drew on, because he did draw on it as a tradition that went from the Brabant poets to the Sicilian poets and the North, and Dante drew as if you were drawing on it. Suddenly there it was, full of the milk of the whole poetry. And Williams begins to draw from Pound, his contemporary, draw in, and actually, not yet in my generation, has this whole theme of money and circulation and usury and so forth formed that place where it will yield. But it is every poet's business, if you feel it, if you sense it's even there, to do that service. Because that's what the imagination is. The real role of the imagination is to find, if you have any sense that enough is there, if you have any sense the good is there, even if you don't know any more than Madame Curie is, than the Curies did, how in the world are you going to get it? And maybe you know very well, you might not, and some of the time, and you will leave hints. You've got a work to do. And that's certain. And I am among those who believe there was a work to do in the whole theme of usury and money and circulation and exchange. Think of how exchange immediately means our emotional exchange, our whole idea of the reality of goods and things. Well, particularly because Maximus has been said to be just an aftermath of Williams, on the level of the idea of the structure, there's nothing, this is one of the first things that also, in projective verse itself throws out this idea. Projective verse decides that it is so destructive to have an overstructure and then have moments of poetry in it, or then have discoveries. It's so destructive to have something like youth, middle, you know, three acts and what do we do in them as a form or something, that the form has got to be in every single locus of the poem. And the reason it does this is because that form that Joyce borrows from Vico, that form, the form of 1, 2, 3 or 1, 2, 3, 4, is a very definite idea about what the universe is like, and a very definite idea about the meaning of human history. And for Charles, out of Whitehead, he believed, no, human history is right here, eternity, that's it. Now, eternity cannot really appear in Madison. And it's not being able to appear is what the poet keeps talking about when he talks about the language not being able to come into it. And he's all, you know, it's destroyed in the fall, he says, or it's destroyed in the river below. It's destroyed in this other image, which is not just, there is no such thing as just a convention. The figure I use for a man who uses such a convention is that he puts a fancy set of chains on himself, and then he says, now, this is just convention, I'm good at dance. And then the man who usually complains about convention says, well, he's sort of hamstrung by convention, but he does have convention on, he has chains. And the man who has this 1, 2, 3, 4 has that 1, 2, 3, 4 on, and their meanings, unfortunately.
And for the whole modern mind, these beings absolutely give you the feeling that you cannot understand anything, and that nothing, that the language won't give you anything. Well, God, if it can, it's not when it's going to. Not when you're 14 old man and sits by the time you really shouldn't, you should be an observing force. So that Maximus actually takes this map and the covers. It's one of the few books and charged in there and says, now the only thing I want on the cover of that book is this map. Because the map is an actual, is the actual area in which this thing is taking place. And that map, of course, can be extended again, and you can explore it in the same way. In other words, you can go on making this map in new terms, describe this geography in the whole series of such concerns. And more than that, you know that map extends in time in the same way. That's when you start to dig. And so that you really do have a stage that is never going to be taken for granted. That's what I mean. The map doesn't lead you to take it for granted, but you do find the map in the poem, have to take the map, and you have to find out if it describes what is. And there is something that is. You cannot take the map and make it. I mean, the poem is how you move around in an area. And Olson's idea of what it is to be a man, the great man, Maximus, by the way, is he said, when I wrote him, well, Maximus, of course, must be that homeless Maximus of the assassinated the Renaissance, the big man on the star map. He said he hadn't thought of it. I don't locate, there's a Maximus of Gloucester, Olson had in mind Maximus of Tyre. Well, the way I operate, just like the cosmos and psyche when I was concerned about, since I know he associates with Maximus of Tyre, that's the one character in history I didn't dare find anything else about. I mean, I felt like if I found out something like Maximus of Tyre, it would do something awful. No, but this again, because these are the magic, because magic is beginning. I'm trying to get across to what it is. You would be infected, or there must be some information. Once you knew who Maximus of Tyre is, that would lead you practically, you know, you could swing over into this business, a taboo can also form. From my own work, I don't mean, if I didn't have a work, obviously I might, my work, as a matter of fact, once I come into contact with Olson, consists of a great many of lines of absolute taboo about finding out certain things about this poem. So that when I work on it, I keep hoping that I'm not going to stumble into finding out anything. Now, the Gloucester is not just on a continent. It's one of the most important things is the edge of the sea. And you'll find that the people of Gloucester, as a matter of fact, it's not on the edge of the sea. It's on the edge of the continent. Let's draw, I'm not sure. Here we've got a pit on the earth for me. The ocean continent it belongs to, Charles takes some time in this poem to describe to you, because he describes Gloucester in terms, when you draw pictures like this, so that's a reason to be. I don't even know. I saw you show a little fish. Well, I've got mommy and daddy in a little closet. This is my endless repeating bit there. I wonder for my daughter in the cube there. He describes in Maximus a double turn to that city, and one place that city exists as the opening of a continent, at the beginning of a continent, but in another place that city exists as a locus at the edge of great schools of fish in the north of the Atlantic, and that's all the business of science. And the men who live on the ocean live in an entirely continent of water, and they live between England and the American continent. But the landmen, of course, Gloucester has another meaning. So that a city like Gloucester, already I'm trying to show you how a city like Gloucester opens up levels of meaning. It already has a dual role. It already has a sense in which, and for Charles, both of these worlds, both the continent we've already seen as a mother, so this is the source of food too, and also a mother, treacherous, the Atlantic is in that. And a man's got to know his depth, and a man's got to make his sounding. And then in that poem of the one screen, where he's talking about just an editor of a little magazine, but the reason he's hitting it, Fellini, is because Fellini called his magazine by the about a name that was the latitude and longitude of the city of Gloucester. So Fellini begins to be either information or misinformation about a holy place. And more than that, if he has just any little magazine, mimeographed or otherwise there, he's a member of this place. He's a member of the secret community because he's active in this field. And he immediately becomes a person. Now, of course, he's just erased. There are little touches, and you're very aware that you do not have to read Fellini by the time you've read that canto. The reason there are a little drive so that you become aware of that is that you don't get misled. And as a matter of fact, but what Charles uses that for is there's a real commune and community where we live. And every gesture we make that is not devoted to giving them what we know of this holy or this good is a real betrayal. And then the only thing our poems, the only test in our poems, is to know how deep the water is. They've got to be tested against the real. And that figure is a marvelous one. Let's see if I can give you that passage in that one, because it's one that I have. It was one of the first places where I saw, where what he was saying was so vivid that I began to unlock for myself. And particularly because, let's say, he has at least something to start on, and that's Whitman. He gives immediate reality to Whitman's sense, too, that the community of poetry is not a community of poets. It's a secret spiritual community within the town, because the ones who appear in this canto, for instance, the poet, as a matter of fact, Fellini, is not a member of the community because he's just betrayed it. He's delivered this stuff that doesn't even see where he is. But there are people there who, even whose eyes have shown that they somehow live in this immediate moment, that is actually inhabited by a group. That's the difficult thing, is that the community I'm talking about are a group of people that can even recognize each other as living in eternity, or as living in this place as if it were one of the holy places. Editor of a Gloucester Quarterly, the eyes which watch you do not look in the plate glass of brown that display, or idly waiting for the bus, sheriff to cover the waiting station. If Luskin had got over his scare last summer, when you were so sillily reviewed in the local press, so sillily that you now show yourself bringing such an issue as this into the public domain. Helen Stein's eyes, and those others, Gloucester, who look, who can still look straight down into your page, into the pages of this sheet you've had the nerve, no different from bearing, to put upon the public. It is not the many, but the few who care, who keep alive what you set out to do, who offer Gloucester poems and stories. The high school flicker is not the end of it. But what you hear bring in, there's no such young thing as you, perhaps. I did, and Helen Stein, Herman Melville. And who does not when one begins? Not me, the Melville, who wrote all the first novels before he hit the low thing. Before he realized I have to write about the whale, I can't go spinning on romances. Nor is it, but he could, but once he saw the whale, he didn't have to make a choice. I mean, he just hadn't seen it. I mean, he saw it in Shakespeare, and there it was. Nor is it something else, what it ought to seek to be, as much as one Carl Olsen used to bring to port from another brown, the merchant. Peak of the ocean floor, he knew so well the care he gave his trade. His listening at 17 to Callahan. At Callahan, 17 to Bullard. Bullard, he said. Olsen could set his dory down as a landsman sows his field and reap such halibut it was to walk the streets of Gloucester different to have a sight of what the rainbow as you should walk it. Have you done your job? I do not know and so forth, but the key here is both to know that sailing this damned ocean, if you're going to make your business fishing, And sailing, it was not a field for careless fishermen, this one. And it was where the real fish were. And the man had to know his sounds. And more than that, wonderful for a poem, he had to listen by his ear to know the sounds. But more than that, what do we mean when we say a vessel sound? We mean it happened. And they knew from the sound what that wood was found. And the information went from one. Now, he gave his trade. Now, Thor has a trade. And Charles, when Pound came from Europe, was imprisoned, and before he went to St. Elizabeth, Charles Olson came forward in this interim period, not yet committed to being a poet, but now he made his decision, the one that led him to write Coming Into Law, and volunteered him with Pound's secretary for 2 years, handling all his mail, because the man was saying, so Dorothy Pound really came and took over the correspondence, and simply because Pound was the man, and Pound was, because you've learned your trade. Now this meant nothing but you learned your trade because this man had been in the waters where you're going to be. And this explains another thing about what a movement is. Where you recognize the points are related to, it's because you're in the fishing business. And somebody else is in some other. And you really, you're not going to, although, by the way, Charles has a great deal about sailing vessels in this too. But there are going to be all sorts of men doing different things that are not going to teach you a thing about where to fish, how it is you tell, how you listen, what it is you have to know to. Now Charles can call on that, of course, because he actually fished as a young man, and especially in the period earning his living in the Depression before going west and on to Harvard, and also because he grew up in this fishing community, so that this gives him an immediate community term, but it serves at every level, because that ocean is one that poets know, and sounding and finding the bottom, and knowing where you are, and knowing what the depth is, and drowning in it even, are all terms that are so immediate to the psychic life of well, where else was the whale? I mean, the sea and the fish and everything in it is translatable at least, but they're not metaphors, because the person who gets into this believes that the whole universe is the process of creation. And this is so different from God making his revelation in Christian terms, because of the Whitehead thing, and that is in Whitehead's universe, God is a cosmic God, not a human God. And the human beings are cosmic beings, not human. So one of the funny efforts in the human universe is that it's anti-humanism. The human universe is really saying that your humanity, the meaning of your humanity is found in cosmos. The meaning of your humanity is in no way separated, so that when you so much as change a phrase in a poem, you are as much a cosmic event as when the wind blows dust in an erosion process, something's happening there, and your poem has no place to be in except the cosmos. And that this, for instance, is a term of, as then he wants to say, the psyche is a term of our discourse, which, taken as being finally true, blinds us to the fact that we're cosmic entities. And so that we are always in cooperation with these forces. And then really, if this is true, then the experience on the sea really can be akin to another part of this experience. I mean, that we can find ourselves doing, acting, wherever we are acting, and wherever we take the thing as performing meaningful actions, that we're responsible to, and that will transform us and everything around us. Language, for instance, which is a current term in all of this group of poets, changing, transforming the language, or working with the language. Now that's very different from the just the part about the writing poems. And then and back at that, you feel a real fishiness. When I went to a theme, just as you feel there's real milk in the earth, real food, something, some vitality of this earth, this earthly, and that really, the minute I start talking about it, I get excited, but certainly the logical part of my mind and keeps objecting, except that I had a man say, I knew when I saw that, and I knew what he meant, because I could feel it. And I have felt it at times, but I can't, any more than he can, bring it to his epiphany where it becomes the final reality, because that happens very seldom. It happens by the cooperation of a great many men. What we all complain about at the present time, and the main exciting thing in poetry, is that so many more people are being involved in it, that an accumulated force begins to form. Think of how much longer that first little group around the world only lasted 3 years before they all went, and then they were interdependent in a way, but they didn't see each other any longer or correspond. Now the correspondences between Julius Olson and Denise Levertov and myself that were once intense are becoming much more infrequent. And there's a general feeling of agreeing, which is deceptive because we didn't agree in the period when we were actually in action. I mean, our letters were, the periods when we wrote intensely to each other were periods of how different all this seemed. And that these ideas become available are because they, and that's why I wanted to give a sort of a history picture, is because they really, the event really took place back in 1954. And our art is going on, and our art draws on it in many ways, but what any new event is, none of us could imagine. Creeley wrote to me just before I came up here. He said that he had spent 2 days with Shaw, and it was marvelous because his mind still was working, trying to imagine what any of this could what could happen to us, I mean, how any of this could possibly now ever find anything new, anything. We are already antiquated. You know, it's one thing that you are, if you get that idea of immediacy, one thing you know, any of you who have not found a poetic yet are new compared with, let's say, I have a poetic that works, it completely absorbs me. Now, only by forcing a crisis within that poetic will a change come. And one of the goals of Maximus, one of the reasons that it's so absolutely excruciating to read, and it is because a man is trying to make his own poetics untenable. I mean, bring it poetic. He can not find the place of crisis, but you'll find if you look through essays and look through poems, you'll find individual poems, for instance, individual Maximus poems, where they touch upon the few places you come across this feeling of cosmic presence, they're beautiful. And as a matter of fact, says you don't find obstruction. But the obstructions, in order not to have the role of obstructing this, is to make those things only at the point where you really are going to be able to make the connection. We all know what piety feels like, or the effort to feel a thing, or the protestation to feel it in between. And as a matter of fact, what happens, the sad thing that happens in religion, is that there's not the obstruction, and so people begin to be in tune with things and in harmony with things, and lose all sense of actual, of vital connection. And I think the only person in the whole group that wants an actual change, a deep change in himself, is Charles. You'll find that as a frequent reference. The real thing, you know, the vision in the projective verse is not just the field. The contrast projective verse is Charles and the use that I make of it in the opening of the field. Now, I take it over completely into the realm of a voice in the opening of the field. Use the idea as if projective verse was describing just, and it does, the possibility of an aesthetic and a poetic. And I mean here by a poetic, a coherent and cohesive of structure within which you can make something. Well, you already see that there's a necessity that for if you want to have something changed, that you not come to a poetic, and Charles really resists coming to one. He keeps trying, and he also has writing block as a consequence, trying to force himself into to be deeply changed, and that would mean a change in the form. It has not happened, and when we look at what is actually going on in the poem, now I want to erase it because I want to get the shape of that poem. I don't think I should, 5-12. Let me just make a few remarks about the shape of the Max. You know, it isn't like I'm going to dig the whole poem. By the way, if any of you have this difficulty reading it, I don't understand very much about it, to follow it off. One of the first things you see, what are you reading now, Robert? I'm now dealing just with margins and page of Maximus.
Which poem is
it? The opening of Maximus. I, Maximus, to you, Gloucester. I, Maximus, to you, Gloucester. Is it in here? Let me take one that's in here, because that's the book we have, isn't it? Is it in
here? Yeah.
Okay.
What page is it on?
Eight.
Now, I'm just going to put block because I'm going to try Gideon's Island. This is taken over by a convention, and in the back of that book, you will find people where the form is not significant at all. You'll find, if you look at, I think it's Leroy Jones is where the form appears, but I don't know whether the poems in here use it. I think that here, perhaps the editor tended not to want to use, I wonder, does anybody know of any poems in here where this business is carried over? It is in younger poets now, frequently. This business of having a block here, a block, and have you see they form little floating islands on the page? It's a very distinctive immediate look the notation has. Well, what I notice is that the one possibility that it opens for somebody who takes the cross without too much reflection is that it gives you a form in which you have not a sequence. It doesn't even suggest a sequence. You see, although you do see in that page, by the way, looking at this page again, you do see that this block is immediately related to that. It gives you syncopated inner organization. You see that these blocks come back, and so the margin begins to have a meaning. This becomes a margin, and this becomes a margin, and you see that here you are returning to this, here you're returning to this, the return to the margin begins to have meaning again. And this makes it possible for you at least to have three large areas. And not thematic, this is what Williams and Patterson would have tended to do with any such areas, that is, develop them as if they should all have the same theme. The real thing about this, because these are compositional elements themselves, that is, as you read it aloud, you recognize that this work, this belongs to this, this is a return to that. Consequently, this doesn't have to be in subject matter a return to this in order to belong. And this makes possible bringing things together because they're formally related that will have some kind of entire difference. I mean, I don't know whether I can find it in the same Maximus that he does that, because I think in the beginning, here he follows on what it is here. This little section is a little lyrical section. It goes, of the birth, O Kylos, O Antony, and Cosmo, sweet love, oh, blessed. All right, now, the line of the music of the thing is going to go, oh, blessed, and then the time, oh, the gentle sequence. But we realize that with the old blessed, the reason there's a break here is because of some kind of thing that we return to here, and the plate graph of my flute graph. Are you going to plate graph? What does it say in that? Plate graph. Plate graph of my study. And this means that as you work, and let's see if in the second page we don't see even more interesting connections in this sort of thing.
Did you show us that page? I don't know.
This is I, Maximus, the block is you.
Oh, there's a problem.
Oh, what?
I think they're rewritten.
The opening one's rewritten. That's why the opening one's rewritten for the... That's true. I forgot about that. It says in the Maximus that the opening of Maximus is written. I'll take the one that's here, and then we might see what the... What page is that now?
Stop
on page 8.
Stop on page 8. Can we shape that whole
page?
Yeah.
Well, for one thing, it's because something is a form poem, must be by now coming into shape. I mean, really feeling. It doesn't mean to write it all lifetime, like Pounder writing the cantos, and where the prompt for it is. Oh my, isn't it? Now, where does this begin to come?
I think it's unfortunate that we don't have the maximum volume, because I think
This is, you see, because now he's wanted to maybe see that. Well, let's just take this abstractly, although that isn't as rewarding, but because for one thing, I'm trying to show you something here about a way that a possibility that I saw. But now what I tended to do with what was hinted at in this form was exceedingly timid indeed. That is, I found that I could not have these areas of composition are like islands of poetic feeling. They permit at least three orders of poetic feeling within a poem. And they permit, for instance, that in one passage you develop to here, and now your syntax, of course, can do it. It does in a regular poem. It can come back as it did from here, and the line I'm reading, oh, bless, and then my city, and so forth. But the change in movement is quite evident. This shape, we already know the short line of what, and so it can be thought of as just a musical possibility. Then you can have long one, and then you can have, and then you can come back to that little, and then have just the. But then the margin begins to be already a notation that the emotional tone here is related somehow, even if it changed violently, that the emotional tones here are related, and that the emotional tones here are related in order. Now they don't have to repeat them, because the difference begins to count when they're in one order, just as in the total order, the syntactic order, the change from this over to this, if you carry the sentence over. And by the way, the disappearance of capitals at the beginning of the line is because in the modern portion, one of the first things that happened was syntax was no longer identical to the line, as let's say the place where the capital appears making a paramount sentence is in Pope, where the line and the syntax became as close as possible, identical. But when you came to complicated syntax, and all modern, and this whole school of modern poetry did have complicated syntax, the first place with the difficulty was the capital letter at the beginning of the line was first, is Mary Moore, because she began to have complicated structures for the sentence carried over, and she had to show that the sentence had carried over, and all of a sudden, all these, and more than that, she had utterances instead of, I mean, she had sentences in this sense, so that these capital lines began to interfere, and she didn't know what to do, and she began to strike straight through and use the capital letter as it makes sense. It's the beginning of an utterance. And in modern poetry, in this tradition, that's the capital letter. It's significant, again, and meaningful, and means something in relation to syntax. Because the margin shows it's redundant to do what the margin was already showing. And the margin then became meaningful because it creates the place you're returning to. And it showed that all of these belong in one order, and these belong in another. Now, another kind of line you've seen, because William started trying to work it, there's a line that descends like that, and then goes back here. But William's line did not, there was a possibility, but actually William's line usually represented a relationship of this kind. Not a vertical, so they didn't form vertical orders here. In my course, they formed vertical orders that are more built on this than on that, because I don't have large blocks of ceiling in this, or I don't work with large blocks of ceiling as Olson does. But Williams's are actually a line that makes possible three orders within each line, but you are still returning. This is a whole line, and you're returning to the new line here. So these are not margins. They're descents and orders. These are three members of a single order, the line. And this order of Williams reappeared, but it also reappears in Olson. Those little phrases and the many commas and short phrases are part of what's happening here. That is the articulation of the line.
And in my poetry, you find a line articulated in between two elements, and you sometimes find this. But when you find this, something even looks like that, it is related to this. It's inner orders within the poem. And then I tended to be, now this is shows what you do when you take a, when you make a poetic right away. Charles leaves all this open and very much always in formation. And so this, let's say he knows this is an area of feeling, this is an area, this margin's another feeling reference, this is a feeling reference. But in my book, you'll find the whole thing organized. And so that anything that comes in one order actually could be read up in the order as a, every time I shift into another margin, I'm conscious of a vertical movement within a thing moving. So that if you were to follow through any of the elements that are on an inner margin, you would find that all those elements are related on a cerebral level, whereas Charles is leaving them all open and feeling an order-defined form of them. So the mic form is the beginning of a convention from this. That is, it's a meaningful convention because I'm making meaning out of it. But the operative meaning is the one he keeps, and that is where you admit that you do not really know what the consequences. You're not going to make consequences of having these orders.
Could you read a passage that illustrates your interrogation?
What I do, or
yeah,
what
you do?
Well, yes, in here. You can, and that's one where you see it right away. Because I am the one person in here who has absolutely refused to be in this anthology until the very last, and so I got to design my own section. I gave everybody a little anthology of me. And it was designed to show the kinds of things that... Now let's take a look at something that's not what you see in Charles, and that's an owl as an only bird for poetry. Now that is actually a composition which is related to a suite. That's on page 41. That's a composition which is related to a suite in music, something like E flat sonata or something like that, where you're capable of having a lot of changing units all belonging in the same. What are those suites of Schoenberg, where you change from a waltz to a, that's what the different sections. Now that is not, of course, what's going on here. It goes on there in a way, no doubt in it, because this is a little lyrical section, and these were long, sweeping lines. There's something related in the musical structure, but actually, an owl is the only bird for poetry. Is not the sort of thing I was trying to. Oh, the one to look at is 46, the dance. Now, writing it. Dancers, this movement makes ordinate are all in the first place measured, syllabically measured lines. And then more than that, dancers, this movement makes ordinate, the dances, our words are measures, as you will see, contain a concentrated gist of something moving through the poem, and all the long lines are permitted then to move out of the way from that. So that you have an inner message that is concentrated like the core of a kernel in a nut, and then you are, the only area in which I have an operation going on, or rather a counterpoint, I feel it is a counterpoint too, the area in which I have anything comparable to the potency of this, and it's not comparable because these large areas, feeling areas, operating open areas in Olson are potentially the place for a change in form. But I'm taking, I'm really driving it to be a form, to be just apoetic to the thing in essence. The only place where it could happen are in those long lines, because they're not syllabically majored, and there I actually permit myself to swing out on little impulses that begin. See, my mind concentrates on the theme of the dance and the turn that comes later, and although it's not in that line. That line is by the way, not there. It's just down to that section of the poem. But when I return to the far left margin of the poem, all of those are open.
and open for all for even little changes. So you find ideas usually, because I can't measure beyond, I don't have conscious measure without counting them, beyond 3 or 4 syllables. I found that in Black Mountain the way you find it, by the way, your conscious measure, and where your conscious measure and your unconscious measure are identical, is of course by deciding you're going to write 7-syllable lines and write, just write, but you absolutely can't measure, and then find out where the conformity comes. And then you know that at a certain level, when you decide you're going to write something, at a certain level, your conscious control is identical with your unconscious intent. And at another level, you don't. You actually don't have any conscious control unless, of course, you manipulate. So I never manipulate. I never operate counting syllables except at the level which I can count syllables. Manipulation happens when you can't count it. You've got to stuff syllables in or make words do things, and that's very interesting, but I'm liable to lose my temper with people when I discuss it very much. Well, it only means that poor education can measure 3 syllables or 4. And I think in Dante's time that if you read the Vita Nuova, Vulgari Eloquentia of Dante, you'll find Dante praising a certain poet because he manages a line with 13 syllables. Now, we could only praise him for managing a line of 13 syllables if there had been a cult in the Provence, and that Dante kept, of finding your conscious control syllables that you didn't count and manufacture. Now, obviously, anybody can manufacture a 13-syllable line. But look at Gerard Manning Hopkins' sonnet line. Are his syllabic major. He always exceeds or is deficient in self. What he keeps are the 5 beats of the sonnet line, but in syllables he's intuitive and has his own form. What you will find in that there is an actual unconscious measure in Gerard Manley Hopkins of the number of those syllables, but he's not counting them. He couldn't possibly. He's going in what he can feel, and is exceeding his conscious count. And what happens is what happens at his turn, this whole area of poetry, a guest forms like the sonnet, is not the sonnet thought to be written, that the majority of them are not written by at the level of your conscious control, but at the level of your imposing upon and manufacturing this 10-beat line. Because it is one of the very primary things for those of you who are interested in poetry, but also, let's say, for those who are interested at all in finding out your relation to words, try the exercise. Try it with each other, whether there's a group of people present. Try saying we're going to write 7 syllables, or try saying we're going to write 7 stressed lines, and then write them so rapidly and realize you're not going to learn anything unless you do, and write 10 or 15 of them, and find out 2 things. Where and how you do get the 7 syllables, and then what it is you do tend to get, because you might find you're hitting a 5 or 6, you might have a very definite sense of it. And what I did find at the time when we were actually working on this on stress, I actually have but by the time you have 5, and I don't have any difficulty using up 7 with a stress intention, you've got a very long line. But with syllable, I just lose all track. I have to start counting on my fingers, or have to start actually looking as if you were counting. And look at the syllables, or remember how many syllables there are. Like, well, there we are. That's, I don't know. Yeah, my work has to
Would you do one thing? Would you do just look a little bit at a song from last
night? Because that's something you've read.
Something we've read, and it seems to me that what you're talking about up here, we were trying to get at.
Why don't we leave a minute or two, as I have when things last a long time, for those to crawl out and have to get home? And I know that you won't be criticizing me by this time if you have to get home. This has been a long session. And then I'll feel a little freer to look at the songs and also try to read them. I try to read them with the Olsen voice, which I can get on to sometimes.
Okay.
Where?
know, and then so that they're more likely to have a sense. It doesn't quite fit. Now, what Brodsky does about all this, he not only gets the convention, but he's finally writing about I'm an old woman, which he really got out of Edith Sitwell, who was the old woman who first wrote it. I mean, and he writes it marvelously. You can identify completely because he's had to identify all the way along with all the series of other people. But the strange thing is that there is a similarity. If you've heard Brodsky read, there's something that happens so that the notation doesn't stand for what you hear, because what you hear is also subject there to a breath, a post like this, and to a loon. He does swing too. He would have been a real poet if it hadn't been for the fact he didn't learn to notate. And consequently couldn't hear that song. Now look what he does. He does something like I was saying. Look how he can bring back to that march a word like song. And play it, and then all wrong. And then sing, and then these little lines, little short ones, will play off against long ones that form another part of the texture of the whole sequence of songs. Now Charles is much easier, much closer. By the way, it is not Webern, but although you've heard some Webern, it's not Webern, but Tatie that gave him the clue to these little short songs. At Black Mountain, Cage had given a whole. Had given an entire cycle of that piece where everything was played and performed. And that actually registers in the maximum degree, because that is my composer. He also is a man who has danced. He danced the giant in the Tannhäuser ballet, and was Tom Sardelli doing the test. He didn't have to do much dancing, but at least he was not able to do more of dance because of this breath condition. Actually, whenever he reads, he does do great deal of swing. So that everything it is a very highly rhythmical life. If you've ever seen Stravinsky conduct, and this same sort of thing is from Charles. And in the same way, when I read my things will find that this kind of real eminence everywhere as emotion is not at all high. And actually the threshold is additional. And if you miss that threshold, you have an awful time reading this stuff. Poetry kept trying to form, poetry kept trying to form a recollected in tranquility. Well, Jesus, you know, tranquility can be stretched right out there as dead as it ever got to be. Please, this isn't very tranquil. And pass the tranquilizer. But we're a period of meat tranquilizers. We can't do our recollections anymore. But what I notice this time I read this is how much this tells me now, because I was developing this picture of the Maximus and the fact that he wanted to make a blockage against things and force a crisis and change. Doesn't that all of a sudden tell us how much he's saying when he says, when you're having it good, when you can really do it, that's the time to start making it impossible? Because this man really could do it. I mean, the thing that's in back of knowing to get the language in tune with your movement and get it so that if you really got through the reading that is indicated by those commas, by those short phrases in some terms, you would get into this, you would really get into this rhythm. For instance, a young composer in San Francisco, Pauline Oliveira, set this last song, You Think You Love Her, Why? It is a magnificent song. She had no trouble at all knowing in this notation what it is, you know, where and how that song is supposed to be. But of course, in sequence, she didn't set the sequence, because in sequence it really does come as a correcting sort of quote. And that you sing, you who also want, is the real command he gave all. Because the thing of this is to sing against the music at the first, you know, the awful music, the music, as he says in the Maximus, and the postcards, dirty postcards and so forth, have to do at one level of reference with conventional verse, because regular antagonism, I am not the only person in this group who will make barbed remarks at every turn about the whole established school of poetry. It refers at that level to that, but then look at here, he gets the nicest, and I get the briefing he gets. victory.
Isn't
that right? Well, you see, but in here, that victory is the victory of a life form that lasted for 300 million years. That's when atomic collapsed. If you remember, the picture in Life magazine, they had no idea that this was the earliest surviving life form that they knew of in a fish form, or rather it was a form they thought hadn't survived. So this really is a nightshade. This is a victory of a thing, of a kind of thing. And so there is a conflict in the picture, you see, that the one meaning that is in Olson is, as he's trying to force this change, he's really trying to force a change in species. What the deep change I'm talking about, a poet finds his form. Now, all of you are protean, and when you begin writing, or if you aren't, it's rather sad because it means that you're rejecting a form that can be immediately satisfied. If right away you write poems that are really noticeably good, this leaves you with an unprotean form, and the rest of your progress with this poem. One of the things about poetry, if you're going to live as long as most of us live, is that you damn well better find a form of poetics that permits enough development that you're still doing something interesting to yourself when you're 82. Mm-hmm. And that you're not just going on writing a new volume of the same thing. Mm-hmm. Now, but Charles means, ooh, I want to change entirely the very inner shape of what I am. Well, then, but then the poem in praise of the colonizer, isn't it? Who that for 300 million years didn't change what it was and remained as an antiquated species and had its vitality. So to praise your own vitality, for instance, is also the preservation of what you are. And everything you ever written now has this stamp or movement.
But now, Robert, now this isn't unfair because you've just begun to look at it again. But what I'm interested in at the moment, and what we were working with somewhat, was how you follow his notation.
Oh, well, all right,
margin,
all right,
and,
I'm just not even beginning on our major. I'm already there, and I think that's wrong.
Are you entertaining him when you move?
Well, I've got to. He doesn't. I weigh considerably less. I'm not 6'8", so in order to make this motion, I don't exactly look like that. All right. But all does is begins on a higher tone and wrong, and this is your margin. In first place, my hand can move and direct it and say all wrong, and move it, and I'm ask myself, I too cover it with a gurry of it. Where shall we go from here? What can we do? Like even a public convention. Sing. How can we go anywhere? Even cross town. How get out of anywhere? The body. All buried in shallow grave. Now, one thing to look at is what they're doing now in linguistics in order to notate the juncture, in order to notate certain changes in American linguistics, in American speech. That itself is fragmenting, evidently, in this order, or has been for the last 20 years or so. The description of the American sentence now has had to give up completely the idea of the grammarians about what a sentence is, and a sentence is defined as an utterance, and an utterance is defined as having a particular kind of juncture, and it's a structural element in American speech. Now, this is very different from British speech, and at least it's not what British linguists are describing as their pattern. And